two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind, until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter, and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Why, hello there. It's your old pal, Sarah Silverman, and I'm back with a brand new season of the Sarah Silverman Podcast. On my podcast, I am talking about everything. Politics? Yeah, we get into it. Favorite sandwich shop in L.A.? I know a few spots, and I'm going to tell you about them. I'm also going to be talking to you. I will be reacting and responding to listener voicemails in real time. Let me tell you, things can get weird, and I love every second of it. Weird is my comfort zone. The newest season of the Sarah Silverman Podcast is out now wherever you get your podcasts.
Lemonada.
Welcome to The Bubble. This is your host, Andy Slavitt. It's Monday, May 9th. Hey, Kyle.
Hi, Andy.
Kyle Sheely, our executive producer, joining us in the studio this morning. So you've been on board now a little while with the new show. What do you think?
It's been crazy. I'm used to the breaking news business. I thought that, I was told by our executive producers, Jess and Steph, that there were no podcast emergencies, but we keep having to redo the show, so I'm not sure that's true, but it's been great. It's been a lot of fun, and we're really getting to tackle some important topics, so I'm glad we're here doing this work.
Yeah, from your perspective and the team's perspective, I mean, you guys turned on a dime. It was midweek that Supreme Court leak came out. For those of you who didn't hear Friday's episode, it was our first Friday conversation. We talked about the just suddenness of the post Roe v. Wade world that seems to be coming upon us. And in the middle of last week, you guys basically said, we got to cancel what we're doing and do a show on this.
Yeah. You sent that to us at night. And I was like, well, there goes the week. As soon as it was posted, we knew that, we couldn't do the show we'd planned. We'd put a lot of effort. Everybody, you missed a great show that unfortunately you'll never hear.
It'll never get made.
It didn't come together.
Yeah.
But
I got to admit, I was nervous about Friday's show. I mean, leading up to it, for sure.
I picked up that you were a little nervous on that. Yeah, I think it's new to you to expand this out. I tried to be calm. I've done this a few times, so I know that sometimes, people don't always pick up on my calmness because they're not used to it, but I knew it would come together eventually. But there were a few moments, especially when we decided to blow up the original plan, that certainly got the heart pumping. But we got there. You've got the first one under your belt, and it's all downhill from here.
Yeah, from my perspective, it's not like people have a random spare hour that they want to spend listening to our show. So, they could get news about what happened in the court anywhere, but so there's a reason why people listen to our show, and I wanted to live up to it in this new format and give people something that they could take away that would be useful. And we just wanted to get it right. So what do you think of the coming week? We got a big show today.
This is a producer's dream week, because you couldn't dream for two guests to come together more perfectly. So today, we're playing a conversation you had with Dr. Deborah Birx about her new tell-all on working in the Trump administration. She was the former head of the White House Coronavirus Task Force. So that is today's interview.
If you had to rate that on a spiciness scale of 1 to 10, how would you rate that interview?
I'd give it a solid 8.5, especially towards the end. It gets a little spicy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I sat here thinking, okay, this is the one chance that everyone has to ask Deborah Birx the question that they wanted to ask her, like whether she was sitting on the wall and that one moment or some comment she made about him. And I'm like, I'm not going to sit there with people around listening to this pounding table going, Slavitt, ask her that question. So But yeah, it got a little spicy. And then Wednesday will be an interesting contrast because we're moving from Trump's COVID response coordinator to Biden's COVID response coordinator, who a lot of people in the show know as Ashish Jha. Could they be more different, Kyle?
I mean, you can't look to the future without looking back. I think that's why this is a great pairing this week. How did we get here and where are we going as we enter another wave of COVID sweeping the country? So, yeah, you can't. I mean, it's great that he's available and giving us the time to share important information with everybody.
You know a lot of people getting COVID?
I have known 3 different radio hosts in the Twin Cities who have COVID and at least one producer right now.
Yeah, it feels anecdotally, you don't see it in the numbers, but it feels anecdotally like a lot of people I talk to, not just where you are in Minnesota, but in San Francisco, in New York, in LA, it just feels like everybody's talking about the fact that they know lots of people with lots of cases.
Yeah, so we'll find out from the guy right in the seat who's at the center of knowing on Wednesday's show.
Well, let's get to Deborah Birx. Hang on, buckle your seatbelt, make sure your airbag's working, and seriously enjoy this. She's an interesting person in all seriousness. I think there's a lot of sides of her that come out in this episode. I mean, she was a serious scientist for a long time before she entered the Trump White House. She's done amazing work in Africa on AIDS. And, you know, the Deborah Birx we know, I try to get a little bit into the Deborah Birx that we know from what we see publicly versus the Deborah Birx, kind of who she thinks she is in her interior life and the contrast. So here goes. Dr. Birx, welcome to In the Bubble.
Thank you, Andy. Great to be with you.
One thing that I find so interesting about you, knowing you a little bit, having read your book, is the difference between the scientist and the inside player, if you will, Deborah Birx, and the Deborah Birx that the public knows or thinks they know from a couple of very famous appearances, and of course, at a time when hundreds of millions of Americans were glued to the TV set. Well, you start by telling us a little bit about the other Deborah Birx and the way you normally have operated across your career.
Yeah, so I what was really important to me, and frankly, the only reason I came back is I could see that people weren't applying practical, common sense solutions that we had developed over the years to combat pandemics in sub-Saharan Africa. So we had been combating HIV, TB, and malaria for more than 2 decades, layer on that Ebola and Zika and concerns about avian flu. I think when you do a lot of on-the-ground work, you understand how important the intersection between governments and their policies and communities and listening. Because it doesn't help to have a lot of policies generated in the capital, or in this case, the capital or Atlanta, and not have them be implementable.
And so there you are. You were actually in Africa, working in Africa, when you got the call and came to the White House. Tell a little bit about your impressions of President Trump. I think not everybody knows the difference between a political appointee and a career member of government service. And so, you know, to some people, they might think, oh, well, the president brought her in. She must have been someone on the Trump team from the start. Clarify kind of how you saw, what your sense of both what you thought was potentially positive and what you were uneasy about in looking at the president and his response.
Yeah, so it's really important that the American people understand that there's 3 branches of government. So there's the legislative branch, and they're independent, and of course the judiciary, and they're independent. Everybody else that's a civil servant is technically in the executive branch. So you could say that anybody that is working for the federal government is in the Trump administration. That's just by definition. But most of us are civil servants. What does that mean? Well, I was in the military, and then I worked for HHS and then the State Department. So always as a civil servant, non-political. Now, what does that mean? That means that you aren't part of that group that is brought in because you served on a campaign, that you would come in for 4 years or 8 years and then leave. And that's a cycle of people who come in. And if you want to really make government work and work consistently on big programs, you have to be non-political. And so I had prided myself and being non-political. But I also knew how this White House, particularly the president, was viewed. And I had spent the last 3 years with my head down trying to keep the program intact and making sure that the critical work we were doing with young women was not compromised in any way. And so I had successfully avoided any engagement with the White House for the first 3 years of the presidency. But I knew, knowing how the country felt and knowing what I had witnessed myself on TV and looking at the number of people who were senior military who ended up in the White House and then leaving, that if I did this, that would be the end of my federal career. And I knew that before I went in. So it's not like this was a shock to me. I knew that if I went into that White House with what I knew of its chaos and complexity, that in order to work in that space, that I would be perceived as part of the system.
Do you feel you were clear-eyed about who the president was and what you were getting yourself into?
Yes, because, you know, when you work, so I've been 3 decades working globally. I've worked with every president and prime minister across the continent of Africa. All pandemics are political. HIV was very political. I knew what it was like to work with presidents who didn't want to deal with the pandemic that they had, but wanted to deal with a pandemic that they wanted to have. There were many presidents in sub-Saharan Africa that only wanted a mommy baby HIV pandemic, that didn't want to deal with key populations, men who have sex with men or people who inject drugs or young women that were 15 and 16 and maybe having sex. They didn't want to deal with those issues. But my job was to make sure that I brought the data to them that showed them that we would not be successful unless we dealt with all of those issues, even though they were politically difficult for them to deal with. And so I had gotten a lot of policy changes across sub-Saharan Africa, many of which people said would never happen, including elimination of informal and formal fees in Western Africa. So I believed that data would speak and that even knowing what I had seen on television from President Trump, I had really a confidence that as with other presidents and prime ministers, that with the right data presentation, that I could get the president to take this pandemic seriously.
Were you right?
I was right for 6 weeks. Well, maybe 5.5. His disruptive personality made confronting this pandemic incredibly difficult because the number one thing that you have in a pandemic as your primary tool before you have anything else is communication and clarity of communication. And so I make it very clear in the book that that was a significant problem. But we were actually making progress with the European travel ban, the 15 days to slow the spread, the 30 days to slow the spread. So we got to the just 8 days after 30 days to slow the spread, which was a very difficult chess game to get us to that place with the data and seriousness of the pandemic. And to find out that another group took my data, changed the assumptions, and went to the president and said, yes, Debbie said 100,000 to 240,000 in this first surge. And let's make it clear, I only modeled the first surge.
You're talking about fatalities in the U.S. in the first wave. Fatalities. In the first wave, okay.
And so they came to the president with a memo that said she was wrong, she used the wrong assumptions, only 26,000 Americans will die. And I think in that moment, that created the controversy and the ability for all of the leaders in the White House who didn't want to take COVID seriously to say, Debbie and the scientists over here are completely wrong. The econ people at CEA who know how to do mathematical modeling came up with a different answer. And by the way, it matches what we said from the beginning, that this wouldn't be worse than flu.
So what you describe in the book is yourself, Tony Fauci, and Bob Redfield, who was running the CDC, had an estimate that this was going to be quite serious, that at a point in time when there had been only a couple of thousand deaths, we were about to experience six figures in deaths. And as a result, you had a series of recommendations that were quite serious relative to anything the U.S. had ever done before, 15 days, 30 days of really being very careful to slow the spread. It's well known we didn't recommend masks, but you recommended social distancing and staying at home and a bunch of serious measures. And you describe how you persuaded the president that that was the right thing to do. At the same time, you also, I think, just talk through that there was another faction in the White House. And those were a faction of people that were singularly focused on the economy. And there was a battle that behind the scenes, and we'll talk a little bit about the public Deborah Birx moments, but that behind the scenes, it seemed like you were saying you were the principal advocate to try to stand in the way of an economic team that wanted to say, let's open the country. And when they used, that's what ended up being completely bad analysis, to say, no, Mr. President, there's not that many people that are going to die. He chose to believe that, and that was the end of the argument.
Correct. And I think that's why you heard him send out those tweets about Liberate Michigan. I never really, after that moment, ever really had access to the president or to the Oval Office. And I just want to make it clear that's very much in contrast to, I think, who Vice President Pence and Jared Kushner believed. So I do believe that there were people in the White House who believed my data, helped me to do what we could behind the scenes, and then helped me alert the governors in a weekly report that I wrote and the daily reports that I wrote to everyone in the White House. So there were people besides myself that were in the West Wing that were helping me. There was no one else that was working on health in the West Wing. And I think that's what kept me there.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. After season one aired, I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season two of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. And of course, my 90-year-old mom, Judy. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me Season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
People love to pretend that there are simple formulas for living your best life now. Eat this and you won't get sick. Manifest it and everything will work out. But there are some things you can choose and some things you can't. And it's okay that life isn't always getting better. I'm Kate Bowler, and on Everything Happens, I speak with kind, smart, funny people about life as it really is. Beautiful, terrible, and everything in between. Let's be human together. Everything Happens is available wherever you get your podcasts.
So one of the things that you learn, and I've worked for two presidents now, is to be very careful to not try to tell the president what he wants to hear, but to tell the president the range of scenarios, the range of potential outcomes as objectively as possible. And in most White Houses, at least the ones I've been in and the ones I know about up until Trump, there's a pretty good process where the chief of staff's office really ensures that balanced information comes to the president. So the president doesn't get the bias of the presenter in the room. And what it feels very much like, and I think the public could see this, so I don't think it's a big surprise, was that Trump was shopping for the news he wanted to hear, which was, in effect, that this could either be downplayed, minimized, wasn't that bad, wasn't his fault, and wasn't worth suffering any economic consequences. And that feels like one of the, you know, people can think about, talk about some of the more unusual aspects of him as a president. But behind the scenes, I found that to be one of the most damaging. Now, let's talk about some of the public moments that the president had and that you had, and the ones that you are better known for. I'd say, you know, I wouldn't be exaggerating to say you may be one of the you may have been in one of the most memed moments of American society that probably ever happened. I want to play a quick clip of this moment that many of us remember.
So supposing we hit the body with a tremendous, whether it's ultraviolet or just very powerful light. And I think you said that hasn't been checked, but you're going to test it. And then I said, supposing you brought the light inside the body, which you can do either through the skin or in some other way. And I think you said you're going to test that, too. Sounds interesting.
We'll get the right folks who could.
Right. And then I see the disinfectant where it knocks it out in a minute. 1 minute, and is there a way we can do something like that by injection inside or almost a cleaning? Because you see it gets on the lungs, and it does a tremendous number of the lungs. So it'd be interesting to check that. So that you're going to have to use medical doctors with. But it sounds interesting to me. So we'll see. But the whole concept of the light, the way it kills it in 1 minute, that's pretty powerful. I would like you to speak to the medical doctors to see if there's any way that you can apply light and heat to cure. You know, if you could. And maybe you can, maybe you can't. Again, I say maybe you can, maybe you can't. I'm not a doctor. But I'm like a person that has a good, you know what.
But, sir, you're the president.
Deborah, have you ever heard of that? The heat and the light relative to certain viruses, yes, but relative to this virus?
Not as a treatment. I mean, certainly fever is a good thing when you have a fever. It helps your body respond. But not as, I've not seen heat or light.
I think it's a great thing to look at. I mean, you know. Okay.
Respectfully, sir, you're the president, and people tuning into these briefings, they want to get information and guidance and want to know what to do. They're not looking for rumors.
I'm the president, and you're fake news.
So I think we all remember that moment. If we didn't see it live, we saw it, you know, and what you can't tell from playing that clip is the look on your face, which is the one that I think famously probably represents what a lot of people were probably feeling. Only you were in the room and had to be in this very awkward position. You could prepare for a lot of things coming into the White House. I imagine that's a moment you could have never prepared for.
Well, you know, I think what's really important, and thank you for playing the clip, because you can hear that two men are having a discussion. And it is the DHS scientist, Dr. Brian, having a discussion with the president, turned 180 degrees away from me in this dialogue. And I think what's really was unfortunate is when it was reported, it was never reported he was not speaking to me. And the implication was that he was speaking to me and I was sitting there letting him go on like this. He was turned away from me. He was talking to this DHS scientist, and you can hear the DHS scientist encouraging him, saying, yes, we'll look into that. Yes, we'll look into that. Now, I had not been party to any of these discussions that had been occurring in the Oval Office before they walked into the press briefing. And I think this is what you just described, the tragedy of lack of process in this White House resulted in these unforced errors that should have never happened. This DHS scientist was asked to study this because I wanted children to be back on playgrounds. And I knew if mothers heard that sunlight could have as much impact on the virus as the clear disinfectant that they were wiping their groceries down with, that they would, and mayors would, reopen the playground. It was incomprehensible to me how a playground experiment, a playground equipment became a dialogue between a basic scientist and the president talking about it potentially being treatment. I thought about this a lot and thought about how I could have intervened. And if I hadn't been so shocked by the conversation, I mean, I couldn't even figure out where this was coming from. I had no idea that the scientist had gone into the Oval Office.
Because he had some, he told them some potentially positive, interesting thing. The president heard it and said, hey, I'm going to bring you to the press conference. And kind of that all just, nope. And basically, no, none of the staff stopped them. They all just were like, let's let this.
Correct. And I wasn't there. So I was actually down in the press briefing waiting for the president to come because I had been assigned to go into the briefing that day. And so I'm waiting for him. And what happens is they show up and they launch into this. First, the DHS scientist presents to the press the findings on how sunlight can disinfect outdoor play equipment. And then it deteriorates into this dialogue between the DHS scientists and the president.
Yeah, look, I don't think there's a lot of people that think you agreed with the president. I think there are, you know, you have gotten criticized for not subsequently coming out and saying in more clear terms, it's very hard to tell the president, hey, you're wrong, buddy, in the moment.
I did. Soon as I left that press briefing, I would tell you within minutes, people had gotten to the president because I asked them to. And that's why the next day he said it was joking and it wasn't a treatment. And of course, I went out on press and said it wasn't a treatment. But I was very worried about the country at that time and people reopening too fast. And I've been criticized by saying, I really want to talk about what we need to do. I said it wasn't a treatment. I want to talk about what we need to do to save lives. Yeah. And people felt like I should have stayed on that topic longer.
Well, is it fair to say, and I think you talk about this in your book a little bit, that you had this very delicate balancing act. You were trying to win credibility with the president so he would listen to you when you said, hey, this is more serious than you think. And you know, he's a guy who famously likes people who like him and agree with him.
Yeah, I want to thank Alyssa Farah because she actually tweeted out a couple of days ago who was actually telling the president the truth the whole time. And she said, I was the sole doctor who consistently told the president the truth. And that is the truth. And every morning I wrote a report and sent it to every White House staff and cabinet secretaries. The truth about the pandemic and the solutions to make to improve it for every American. When the president stopped listening, the vice president continued to listen and he facilitated me to translate that work down to every state. And that's what I did. I just don't think you give up when you're the only one in the White House. You cannot walk away and say, you know, this is too difficult. I'm going to stop now, or my reputation is at risk, so I'm going to stop now. When you're working on a pandemic and you know what needs to be done, you find a way or make one.
Well, actually, it's not theoretical, Deborah. It's actual. We actually know what happens in a situation where you fall out of favor because you do cross the list and there are consequences. And I think I tweeted some, this was months later, but I think I tweeted something to the effect later of, you didn't like Deborah Birx, ? Meet Scott Atlas. But I do want to just stay on this question of that. I think where most people know you and where you get criticism, you put yourself in a position that I think people should be pointed out, where people who don't like Trump were upset with you, and soon were people who did like Trump were upset with you. So you weren't, I don't, if you're running a popularity contest, if that's what you were trying to do, then you were running it quite badly. So I would argue that you were in a difficult spot. But I want to play one of those difficult moments, probably the one that you enjoy hearing the least, which is the moment when I think you, people would say you beefed up the president's credentials in a more significant way, which allowed, I think, him to have a lot more credibility on some of the things he was saying.
He's been so attentive to the scientific literature and the details and the data. And I think his ability to analyze and integrate data that comes out of his long history in business has really been a real benefit during these discussions about medical issues.
So after that clip, a U.S. senator called me, incredibly disheartened. He and I had conversations where we had both agreed it looked like what you were doing, and there was very much fighting the fight and trying to make the case, the serious case of the president. And he was very disheartened, and he said, she just gave him legitimacy to every stupid thing he's ever said. Do you, when you look back on that, I mean, maybe bring us back to that moment. Is that the wrong interpretation?
Totally. And this is the problem right now with our country. Bad people that we dislike can do the right thing in a particular moment. And I stand by the fact that when I got to the White House and I integrated data and I put it in front of him, we did the European travel ban based on the data because I said, look, we're exactly the same place as we were with China when you did the China travel ban. So let's use data to do data. It was the data that drove him to do the 15 days to slow the spread. And I just want to be very clear. There was an entire group in the White House who were counseling him that this was not a big deal. And that's what I came into. This is no worse than the flu. There's no reason to do anything. We've got this under control. And the president's tone changed with that data. To be honest, I was surprised at how well he was looking at the data and using it for these policy decision-making, because I didn't expect it. I truly did not expect it. And when we got the 30 days to slow the spread, which I was the sole physician who was going to push for 30 days, others on the task force wanted to try to do another 15. I knew it wasn't going to be enough. I thought we had one shot at this because we were already losing the president's attention. The fact that he went through all of the, now you don't know me, but I'm a big PowerPoint data graphic person. That's what I've used throughout my lifetime.
I've seen them.
You've seen them, I know. I find out that governors that are aware of business and tracking business do understand the data and graphs quite well. And to be honest, I was surprised that the president listened to me. I mean, I just want to take people back to that moment. He has had everyone around him telling him this wasn't a big deal. He has had the entire task force telling him that this virus could be contained. And then this woman who he's never met before shows up in the White House with a list and says, we have to change everything and this is what we have to do. And shockingly to me, he did. And then I don't know what people wanted me to say. I guess they wanted me to go out and say the president doesn't understand anything. I don't know. In that moment, he was believing the data.
I think what they want, well, look, if what you say is true, that he was incredibly attentive to scientific data, your statement also had the benefit of participating in the way other people influenced the president, which was object, bold, flattery, publicly. And so that may not have been your intent, but
it was not my intent. My intent is always to tell the truth.
But it certainly was what everybody else, how everybody else influenced him, and you were trying to influence him. So it may have had, that may have been a side benefit.
But remember, you know, I think, Andy, what you don't, I think what people don't realize is I was not here in the United States. So I am not seeing the president the way you're seeing the president because I'm overseas all of the time. So I'm only coming in for one mission, and that is to get the president of the United States to switch from saying the risk is low and not, we're not worried about this, to doing aggressive actions and allowing states to take aggressive actions to change the course of this pandemic. And in that moment, I would say for those 4 to 6 weeks, he did believe the data, and I think he did act on the data, and then he didn't. And you can see I never went out again and said any of those things. I had plenty of opportunity to do press all across the country.
Would you agree that you're one of the few people to ever say that he's data-driven? I mean, this is a guy who's gut instinct-driven. His friend was in the hospital and dying. We could see him emotionally react to that. He's instinctual. not a lot of people have said the guy's data driven. I think you'd agree with that.
Well, you know, people could say that about presidents and prime ministers across the world, but I've been able to use data to convince them to enact policies that are against their intuition, against their gut feeling. And so I guess it's my long history of using data and ensuring that presidents and prime ministers understand it to the point that they can approve the right policies.
Right.
In the end, it was true in that moment, and then it wasn't.
Welcome to The Dough, where cash is queen and we hardly know her, but we're still here figuring her out together because, y'all, season two is here. Hosted every week by me, X-Maya. Remember me? I'm going to be talking to all types of people about their relationship to money. I'm talking to reality stars, entrepreneurs, financial experts, and even some of my own friends. Basically, anyone who will get real with me about their dollars, how they make money, how they spend it, and how they save it, because I'm trying to retire early, people. Season two of The Dough is out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Can't get enough of your favorite Lemonada Media podcasts? By subscribing to Lemonada Premium today, you'll gain access to fun and inspiring bonus content from all of our podcasts across the Lemonada Media Network. As a subscriber, you can listen to never-before-heard interview excerpts, behind-the-scenes segments, and continue to uncover new ways to make life suck less through all of our exclusive subscriber audio. Check out a free trial of Lemonada Premium today in the Apple Podcast app by clicking on our podcast logo and then the subscribe button.
As we sit here today, this week, there are a million people that have lost their lives in the U.S. It's undoubtedly a lot larger than that, but let's just focus on the million. Very rough, very, very rough math. Estimates from places like Kaiser Family Foundation are that about 250,000 of those lives have been lost after the vaccine by unvaccinated Americans, people whose lives, most of which would have very likely been saved, about a quarter of those lives. There are also, by the way, estimates that something you point out, take great pains to point out in the book, that the slow start both of the CDC and Trump in recognizing the virus was very costly. And that's there's been estimates that have shown that those delays have also cost potentially hundreds of thousands of lives. Either way, there have been a lot of preventable deaths in this country. I wonder if we could just reflect, I mean, just step back a little bit and reflect on having lived through this experience when, just call it maybe even just rough justice, half of the losses didn't have to happen. Some of it because people don't trust science or don't trust the vaccine. Some of it because of a poor government response. How do you reflect on, let me take it in two pieces. The lack of trust in science, in public health, in institutions, in the vaccines, and what that tells you about us as a country.
Well, let me be very clear. It is an excuse to say these people died because they are unvaccinated. And let's just be clear, because most of those people who have died because they were unvaccinated were not necessarily anti-vaxxers. In fact, I think a very small percentage of them were. Most of them were vaccine hesitant, and most of them didn't have access, and most of them were not given the opportunity.
When you say most of them didn't have access, I agree with you that most of them were vaccine hesitant, not anti-vaxxers. I agree with you that most of them have had many of their other vaccines. I don't agree with you that most of them didn't have access.
Okay, so the reason I say most of them didn't have access is because when you go into these rural communities, they need someone to explain to them about these vaccines and what these vaccines can do and can't do. And so it's just not a matter of putting the vaccines in Walmart. You have to have a communication plan at the local level that actually outreaches to churches and to community centers and to schools and explains to people how these vaccines work and what the capacity of these vaccines are. So when the vaccines were implied to do more than they could do, which to my mind was evident from the beginning, we never studied prevention from infection. It should have never been out there that these vaccines could deliver herd immunity, that if you were vaccinated, you couldn't infect your grandparents. They could see then in July of 2021 that vaccinated people were getting infected and were infecting others that were unvaccinated. And so that communication, that fractures trust. And so what I keep saying in the book
is, that because of Delta, or was that true with the wild type virus as well?
Andy, that's such a, we knew this virus would mutate. All RNA viruses do. So we knew that we knew that we would never maintain the original strain. All of us knew that have dealt with virology.
Well, I'm just trying to go back to the beginning, to November of 2020, when the vaccines came out, and you said we knew that it wouldn't offer
because we didn't study it, Andy.
Protection.
We only tested symptomatic patients in those trials. We didn't test.
I think we didn't know either way, right?
Exactly, but we implied it would. That's my point. That's my point. You have to be clear to the American people from the beginning of what you know and what you don't know. Because when you don't explain what you don't know, it comes back to fracture trust. And that's my whole point, is we have to be, as public health officials and as political individuals that are running the country, much clearer to the American people about what things can do and what can't be done. Same way with masks. Every time that we've had a problem with misinformation, it's because we didn't put out the data that shows that masks worked bidirectionally. And when I got out there in the country, no one could understand how two sides of the same cloth could only work one direction. So when it doesn't make sense to them, then they become against the information because they believe they're being lied to. And so telling people what you know, as well as making it clear what you don't know, is absolutely critical. And then showing the evidence base and data that allowed you to come to that conclusion. And we're still not doing that today. We're getting data the end of April about people who died in January who were vaccinated. That breaks trust. We had that data in January. We should have told people in January. The reason we're asking you to get boosted is because people that are vaccinated are infected and dying. So there is a way to do this. You have to be transparent. You have to make data available. You have to make it available in real time. And you have to make everybody have equal access. Talk about equity. Equity means that everybody, not just CDC, not just HHS, not just the President of the United States, but everybody can see their data from their community in real time.
So what you're saying, and I certainly agree with you, is we've done a poor job communicating, certainly in critical moments, about the vaccine, what it does, and that lost some people. So granting that, maybe I'll ask you this way. If you go back to November of 2020, what percentage of Americans did you believe would get vaccinated? Eligible Americans.
You know, in that moment and the way the vaccine had been studied, and I talk about this in the book, I believe that we should have prioritized those people who we knew were going to have severe disease and said to them, we want you to get vaccinated to save your lives. And here's the data that shows that we believe if you get vaccinated, your life could be saved. And then be very clear that we didn't know about the durability of protection.
I thought we rolled it out to nursing homes.
No, we rolled it out to healthcare workers and people in the hospitals who worked in hospitals first. And even though there were risk groups within there that should have been vaccinated first, there were also individuals in that original group who wouldn't have gotten severe disease. And so I think from the beginning.
So you wouldn't have rolled it out to healthcare. You wouldn't have rolled it out to healthcare professionals. You would have just done the congregate care settings.
In November. And think about how many of those congregate care center lives would have been saved if they would have been the first immunized, because we knew that that's where the vaccine would have the biggest impact.
I guess where I'm going with this is, you know, there were the polls at the time of U.S. population said that there were about 40% of Americans who for sure wanted to get vaccinated. This was at the turn of the year and at the turn of the administration. There were another 30% of fence sitters. There were another 20% of, these are rough numbers, of very unlikely, and another 10% of hell no's. Rough math. And so as we sat there with 40% and, you know, the job being to convince the next 30%, you know, I don't think it was ever in the cards, my view. And I talked to almost everybody who'd done, you did a lot of, talked to a lot of people who did the modeling around how many people were going to die and those other things. I talked to everybody who built the model around vaccine acceptance, vaccine hesitancy, probably 30, 40 different experts around the world. I never felt that as a country, we had any chance of getting to 80% with a vaccine as new as the one we had.
But Andy, yeah, we didn't even know what the problem was. And this is really the reason I wrote the book. It is not just the fact that we had that survey. It was that we had known that for at least two decades with the flu vaccine. And rather than taking that data and translating that into action, year after year, trying to improve those rates so we knew how to overcome vaccine hesitancy, all we did was measure the fact that people weren't getting vaccinated and did nothing to use that data to find solutions. You know, a lot of this is on us. And that's why when we talk about pandemic preparedness, it is not an abstract thing that happens over here. It is a clear call to action about rural healthcare, tribal nations, understanding adult immunizations, doing behavioral research to understand behavioral science around how people communicate and how people accept information. That's what we had to do to change the course of the pandemic in Africa. We're not doing this in our own country.
I agree with you. I agree with you completely. I actually think there's another factor too, on top of all that, which is less to do with the pandemic and probably harder to solve, which is just how many people feel disconnected and distrustful from society as a whole. And in other words, there aren't a lot of people they're going to hear from that they trust. They don't trust the government. They don't trust pharmaceutical companies for sure. They don't trust big institutions. They may trust their own physician. They may trust their church. They may trust people in their lives. But if they're in a set of like-minded people. And it's not just on the issue of the vaccine, which is why I say it's not just a vaccine issue. It's on a number of issues where people are feeling disconnected. And it, you know,
let's stop measuring it and find what works down at the ground level. And that's really my plea. And that's the whole appendix.
Sure, but I don't know that answer is a healthcare answer. I think that answer is a much broader answer.
It absolutely is a broader answer. If we had approached the HIV pandemic as solely a biomedical issue, we would have failed. No, we approached it as a structural issue in young women's lives and addressed those issues. It had nothing to do with healthcare, but you couldn't ignore them. We've ignored those issues for decades, and now it is coming back and clear reality how that resulted in many more American deaths than needed to occur. But it doesn't help today for people who are immunized to get a superiority complex or for the media to talk about red counties and blue counties, implying it's how they voted that determined how they view America. No, that's a consequence. That is an outcome. That is not the reason these issues exist. And so we can continue to point fingers and measure it and do nothing about it, or we can say that this is a crisis in America and do something about it. And so I'm going to do something about it. I'm going to do something about rural healthcare. You're absolutely right, Andy. I went to places that had less access than Uganda. This is unacceptable on so many levels. So I know you don't know me that well. I'm a very passionate person. I'm very much committed to our tribal nations. They taught me a lot about community as well as the universities. I think we haven't tapped into our young people. I think they can be enormously helpful. And I think it's on us. Now we know what the problem is. Let's stop talking about it and let's do something action-oriented about it.
Well, we got to a lot of great topics today, and I think that's a great place to finish. I'll be remiss if I didn't ask you one other question about the role of public health going forward in this process. And let's start with our mutual friend Tony Fauci, and what, you know, as a microcosm, what has been done in certain communities for sure to his reputation, but it's broader than Tony. There are a number of people who believe, many of them in the Congress, many of them in the country, that this whole pandemic was an exercise of public health officials having too much power, too much sway over our lives, too much influence. And the evidence of that is all the fact that, hey, they're still alive because in their backyard, they're fine. So this was all really a lot of disruption for nothing. And that many people would predict that as challenging as things are, we're going to see fewer parents give the MMR vaccine to their kids and more distrust of public health and even less funding for public health as one potential outcome of this scenario. Now, how do you reflect on that and the reputation? And some of it may be related to the CDC, some of it related to the way things played out, some of it just related to people are just exhausted from all this and need a place to point their fingers. But it feels like public health has not emerged out of this stronger than it went in.
No, and that's on all of us, because I think, to be honest, we didn't approach it with the requirement that we all have learned in executing public health. Nothing was more disruptive than HIV on the continent of sub-Saharan Africa, where a quarter of the adults were dying from HIV. But also, nothing was more magical and mystical in people's thinking about what caused AIDS, how you kept from transmitting AIDS to others, how you could cure yourself from AIDS. And you have to tackle those misperceptions. You don't give up. You get into the villages, you get into the communities, you find the opinion leaders, you sit down with them. And imagine if we had been doing that for the last decade over many of these other health issues that people have confronted. So we have to be honest with ourselves. Our public health institutions have not responded to the needs of Americans. And that has left rural America behind. It's left tribal nations behind. It has not provided clarity on what people need to do to improve their overall health. And it made us incredibly vulnerable to a virus that preyed on comorbidities. And so I think it's on all of us to translate this lesson into action to assure that it doesn't happen in the future. And let's stop talking about Republicans and Democrats, and let's talk about communities and where communities live and meeting them where they live and listening to them and work with them in partnership to change the future of their lives and the lives of their children. I know that is possible. We did it overseas. We can do it here in America, but we have to get out of our ivory towers. We have to get out of Atlanta and Washington, and we have to meet the needs of communities where they are.
Well, Deborah Birx, that's a great call to action to end on. I so appreciate your time and for you coming in the bubble.
Thanks, Andy.
Okay. Well, I'm still here. I think that was quite a conversation. Interesting. The visuals of some of those interview questions were also interesting, and maybe you'll see some of it on social media if they play back some of those moments. They got a little bit tense, but I think she tried to answer honestly. I mean, and I think she's a serious scientist. I guess she does believe truly that Donald Trump is a data-driven scientific-oriented president in her heart. And maybe she's right and I'm wrong. You feel free to let me know. Let me tell you what else is coming up on the show. Wednesday, Ashish Jha, as folks know, he's been on the show a couple of times. He's the new White House response coordinator. We're going to talk about the current wave of cases. We have our Friday conversation coming up, just like last week that we did on Roe. If you haven't listened to that, please do give us some comments on what we can do better. And then Monday, John King from CNN. He's the dude who always stands up on Election Day and draws circles in the screens and pokes on the screens and so forth. And you've got a lot to talk about with him. If you haven't never heard him and kind of when he has his guard down, he's a very interesting guy. And we're going to talk about a lot of things that'll be coming up and interesting. He's had a very interesting Ohio election. We've got the impact of Roe on the election. We've got the impact of the pandemic on the election. I know that's the last thing a lot of us want to think about is the election, but I'm going to force it down your throat with John King coming up next week. It'll be fun. Okay. Talk to you on Wednesday. Thank you for listening to In the Bubble. We're a production of Lemonada Media. Catherine Barnes, Jackie Harris, and Kyle Sheely produce our show, and they're great. Our mix is by Noah Smith and James Barber, and they're great too. Steve Nelson is the Vice President of Weekly Content, and he's okay too. And of course, the ultimate bosses, Jessica Cordova Kramer and Stephanie Whittleswax, the executive produced the show, and we love them dearly. Our theme was composed by Dan Malad and Oliver Hill, with additional music by Ivan Kuriev. You can find out more about our show on social media at Lemonada Media, where you can also get a transcript of the show, and you can find me at Ace Lavitt on Twitter. If you like what you heard today, why don't you tell your friends to listen as well and get them to write a review? Thanks so much. Talk to you next time.
Do you ever get hit with a cringy memory of your 13-year-old self out of nowhere and suddenly you're panic sweating and laughing at the same time? Don't worry. We all get that. It's because being an adolescent is one of the most visceral shared experiences we have as people. And we want to talk about it. Join me, Penn Badgley, and my two friends, Nava and Sophie, on Podcrushed as we interview celebrity guests about the joys and horrors of being a teenager and how those moments made them who they are today. New episodes of Podcrushed are out on April 24th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Join us on Archetypes, a dynamic podcast hosted by Meghan, the Duchess of Sussex, as she digs into the labels that try to hold women back. In each intimate and candid conversation, Meghan is joined by guests like Serena Williams, Mariah Carey, Paris Hilton, Issa Rae, and Trevor Noah as they delve into the roots of countless common descriptors of women, like diva, crazy, dumb blonde, and the B word, and redefine and reclaim each identity along the way. The complete season of Archetypes is out now. You can listen ad-free on Amazon Music or wherever you get your podcasts.